Welcome to Uncle Nene's Nerdcast. I am your host, Nathan Fletcher, a.k.a. Uncle Nene. We have a great show for you today. Our guest is a creator of the fantasy series Brotherhood of the Wolf. It's a really neat dark fantasy series, and I'm really happy to have him on the show. To get started, I want to start with the trailer, and then we'll come back and we will meet the creator, Wes Aldar.
Brotherhood of the Wolf. Tales of Chaya. The door is open. The choice is yours.
All right. Welcome to the show, Wes. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Uncle Nene. I'm going to call you Uncle Nene. That's one of the best names I've ever heard.
Well, thank you. My nieces and nephews gave it to me. So it was when I was deciding to do this, I knew exactly what to call it. It's perfect.
Nice. Like you could, if you make a competitor to Chuck E. Cheese or Dave and Buster's. It's just like Uncle Nene's. Come on down.
Right. Oh, that's great. So first, thanks for being on the show. You sent me the trailer last night. I was impressed with it. It has mystery, intrigue. It gives you a good feel for what it is. But I will let you tell the audience why, for anyone who's never heard of it, tell them what is Brotherhood of the Wolf and what was your inspiration for it. But we'd love to hear more.
Yeah. Thank you. And just but in case anyone's curious, that trailer that you saw is just like a pretty short teaser. The full trailer people can get if they go to the website and sign up to the list. But that aside, yeah, I think one of the things about Brotherhood of the Wolf that made me get into it was really I wanted to solve certain problems that I was seeing. And the genre that I most love, which is fantasy. Obviously, I like a lot of different genres. Right now I'm reading a mystery written in the 1930s. I think it's called the Mystery of the Traveling Skull, and it's like a kind of a noir detective thing. But so like my tastes are all encompassing, but I have a special love for fantasy, and I think one of the things that I realized with that is, with when you pick up fantasy. The point of fantasy is it pulls you into a world where anything could happen, right? I mean, I think a classic example of that is, The Wizard of Oz, right? Where you literally, the protagonist goes into a different world. And, with fantasy, as opposed to, I think, better than any other genre, whether it's sci-fi or horror or action or anything like that, is that in the fantasy, you could let loose and your imagination could run wild with possibilities. So if you read a good fantasy, you'd be hooked. And so you'd pick up another and another. And over the years, you'd devour fantasy after fantasy, trying to immerse yourself in these worlds that never really existed, but you feel like they could in a way emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
the question, always is it the character you fall in love with or the world or a mixture of both? Because I think a lot of it's the universe that you are transported to, the universe itself is what you fall in love with. And then there are the characters as well. How do you go about it? And when you came up with this, with Brotherhood of the Wolf, did you start with the world first? Or did you start with the kind of protagonist and the characters first? Which happened for you?
I started with the world first, but for me, it's like kind of avoiding some of the problems I started seeing, right? Because what were those problems?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you start looking at those, like going through all these things, reading all these fantasies, you kind of start to notice, trends and, they could be small at first. So you might read two very different stories that has an orphan girl as a protagonist. You're like, all right, fine, cool. But then you start noticing like common like tropes and plots. The underdog who always overcomes evil to win in the end once you've read enough, where every story is going to go before it finishes. And you're wondering when is somebody going to create something original, something new?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Just to add to a point to that, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the things I'm always telling my wife when we're watching something, I'll be like, here's what's going to happen. And I'm rarely wrong. I'm rarely wrong, but I've watched so much content that there are certain things that, you know, it's rare when a show surprises me. One of the moments that I think stands out to me was watching Game of Thrones. I did not read the books. Yep. So I kept expecting Ned Stark to escape somehow. Yep. And up to the point when they chopped his head off, I thought he's going to get out of there somehow. So did you have the kind of same experience with writing your book where you're like, I need something that, you know, you chop the hero's head off. You need something that takes people by surprise.
Yeah. And you know, here's the thing about Ned Stark that you mentioned, like, in the game. So when I reading the books, I was also like surprised pleasantly as well. Because the thing with the Ned Stark, character is like, yeah, you get this idea that he's the main character of the series in the first book, and not only that, he's like also one of the main point of view characters,
right?
And I think before Song of Ice and Fire, Game of Thrones, you didn't really see point of view characters getting killed if they were the protagonist, right? I mean, it just didn't really happen in popular fiction. And so for me, it's just like that really spoke to me, because for me, it's just like, yeah, to your point, it's like there's the twist piece that I think we really like that we're not getting enough of. But then there's also the implausible aspects of so many hero stories. Like, you know, I mean, if you, I don't know how much, I'm sure, like, if you've consumed a lot of content stories, you'll notice that a lot of heroes seem to master magic systems like overnight, even if it took their predecessors, their masters, whatever, like decades to learn. It's like, oh, you've learned this in a week, young one. Are you the chosen one? It's just like, I hate that crap. Or, you know, the fact that, like, you know, like I mentioned, the heroes always win no matter what. Like, I think one of the things that really is cool about the Song of Ice and Fire is that you really don't know what's going to happen next with the main characters. I mean, that's really good. And that really, I feel like adds a lot to the value of the story, you know. I know, because sometimes heroes lose, and if you're being honest, you probably want to read something with relatable, realistic characters who follow the rules of the world in which they live. So if a magic system takes decades to master, it doesn't make sense for the hero to suddenly get it after, like, a, you know, after school type encounter, you know. So so for me, it's just like, to your question, it's like I had that situation where I was like, man, I wish somebody would create a story that's character driven and personal, and making me truly care about the people I'm investing in, because the point of the world is to give the characters something to interact with, right? The world, it's world building itself isn't really storytelling. Storytelling is about the characters, their desires, them trying to achieve those desires and whether or not they succeed or not. And, you know, the internal transformation that happens with all that, that's the story. The world needs to be configured in order to make that happen. But I think a lot of people just, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your world, the world of Brotherhood of the Wolf, you know, 30,000 bit view, if you were trying to explain it to somebody that had never heard of it, what is this world made of?
Yeah, so I would say, like, from a comp point of view, it would be like, imagine The Witcher, but if it took place in the 15th century Ottoman Empire. So,
okay.
Yeah, so yeah. Essentially, it's like an alternate history of the 15th century Ottoman Empire, so around the 1440s. And that's when it starts. And really, it's about us following along the journey of these very unlikely group of characters who are kind of, they've got unique skill sets, but they're also kind of weird and have their own flaws. And them going about, essentially, in an ad hoc way, forming a monster hunting guild, right? And because the Ottoman Empire was always like, the government didn't have too much in terms of running the day-to-day life of people, like in the same way that modern governments do, where, but how did society, you know, a huge empire like that function? They had guilds, which are like these nonprofit orgs where it's like, okay, you had a guild for leather workers, where you had a guild for people who worked with metal, et cetera. And right. So it's just like, okay, well, if there's monsters in this world, there would need to be a guild for hunting monsters. And so that's the Brotherhood of the Wolf, right? Because these guilds were called Achi guilds, which means brother. So it's literally the Brotherhood of the Wolf. And, you know, because the wolf in Turkic mythology has a very special meaning, both of like just being a badass symbol, but also of protection, etc. So it's like Brotherhood of the Wolf is literally like this, the story of this monster hunting guild in the Ottoman Empire, where they like hunt monsters, djinn, you know, one of the first monsters that they'll have to fight against is like a demonic cyborg. a Renaissance era demonic cyborg. So you just a lot of crazy stuff. So there's a lot of horror.
Is like the magic or all the rules of magic very firm, or is it kind of soft rules?
I'd say it's like not hard, like you'd see in something like Brandon Sanderson's work.
Okay,
but not totally mysterious and wooey like what you saw in Song Divide. I think it's in the middle. Like you kind of get an idea of the general rules, but it's not like Harry Potter was like ippity boppity boo when something pops up, because a lot of the magic here is like very like dark, and so like if you want to do something genuinely magical, it's going to entail like human sacrifices, dealing with demons, etc. And so generally
is generally for adults or at least mature scenes,
you know,
or how
I, you know, here's the funny thing. We created this with adults in mind, but but we had some people reading our chapter zero, The Lesser Evil, which is our first thing we're producing, which is like kind of a prequel type, chapter zero, so kind of an origin story for one of our characters. And, you know, we had people read that and, you know, people bought it. And the thing that came up over and over again, like, oh, I want to show this to my kids. And I'm like, what is this? And it's like, yeah. So it's like, surprisingly, there are people who are having their kids read this and the kids are enjoying it. And I'm like, wait a minute. How is this? This is not my intent. This is not what I intended. This is not part of the plan. And you know, I asked one of them and he's like, you know what? Listen, the violence that's in your books, the violence and the gore, it's nothing different than what these kids are seeing in video games, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Like, and is there kind of, my question about violence is always, is there a moral lesson or any kind of, you know, reflection on the violence in your material?
100%. Yeah. So the thing with I think one of the reasons that makes the people who read our stuff, like, show it to their kids and they're cool with that, even though it can get pretty gory and brutal, is everything that we do in the comic books is in service of the story. And the story is done in service of, at a like underground level, the themes that we're exploring, right? So for The Lesser Evil, the chapter zero of our series, it was really about exploring the idea, the theme of like choosing the lesser of two evils, because people always feel like they have to do that. But it's like, you know, what if you took that to its most extreme? Where does that take you? Yeah. Right. And so the story, including the violence of that particular story, is in service to that theme. So it makes sense. It's not like gratuitous. It's like people read it and like, yeah, this hits, this slaps, as the zoomers like to say. And you know, same like with the trailer that you saw, that's kind of a trailer that talks a little bit about the, our first story arc, which encompasses issue number one through issue number five. We call it the Blood Tax story arc. And really that the theme of that story is about, I think, you know, it's quoting Julius Caesar from, as quoted by Shakespeare, which is like, you know, a hero dies once, but a coward dies 1,000 deaths. And so that's what we're exploring, the themes of cowardice and bravery. And so like, even though there's definitely violence and gore in that, and I think you saw a little bit of that in the teaser that I shared with you, it's in service to a greater theme. And so, it's not, you know, because it's very easy to be like, we're going to draw all these comic pages and it's going to be people's guts ripping out, getting ripped out, and this guy getting bisected on the next page as he's getting eaten by, you know, Japanese dung beetles. But
it's like, violence, you know, what's the point? Violence or you know, strangeness, magicalness for the sake of the magicalness is never works out. And I think of, Netflix has a movie called Rebel Moon that I really wanted to like. I really wanted to enjoy it, and I couldn't. I watched it a couple times trying to enjoy it because it has some amazing visuals, but because the character's development is so poor, you don't care about if anything happens to these people. So there's no emotional investment for whatever reason. I just didn't feel attached to the people. And so it didn't matter if this person dies or that person, you know, there was no risk because there's no attachment. And so I love to hear you talking about doing violence with the story in mind. That's great. I do have a question for you. I read that your main character, Nikephoros, who becomes the masked warrior Koja, goes through a dramatic transformation from a pampered young noble to a hardened fighter. And my question is, it is challenging to change a character and do it well, right? Yeah. Where they start off on one point and then they end up becoming someone completely different. And so can you tell us a little bit about that journey and, you know, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, without spoiling too much. So what I will say is, you know, whenever you talk about an origin story, the best way to do an origin story is to answer a question, right? And for us, the question was, why does Koja wear the mask?
Right.
Because actually, right. Like, in terms of the chronology of the story, the Lesser Evil is chapter zero, and then there's chapter one and two, et cetera. But in terms of, like, production, we started with issue number one. And then we were doing issue number two. I'm like, you know, it'd be nice if we created something, you know, short and sweet that explores a little bit of Koja's past. And so we did that. I'm like, okay, well, we need to answer the question, I guess, of why he wears the mask, right?
Right.
And so from there, it's a matter of like, okay, well, why he wears the mask is a very surface level question. But I think the question that you're asking is like changing his character, changing in a dramatic way from pampered a boy to, you know, badass warrior.
Yes.
And I think that the key thing is the desire line. Even when he was like young Nikephoros, he always wanted to be a warrior.
Okay.
It's just for him, he didn't really know what it entailed at the time. At the start of the Lesser Evil, he thinks like, oh, I'm, you know, starts off as a Byzantine noble. And it's like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm part of the aristocracy. I'm going to the school where I'm going to be an officer and I'm going to be a warrior and it's going to be great. So he has this idea of like the aesthetics of being a warrior. But things happen where he has to deal with the reality of being a warrior, which is not fun.
That's great.
And it tears a lot of hardship and sacrifice. And I think he learns that lesson, just unfortunately, in a very tragic and hard way.
That's a remarkable storytelling technique there, where you can explore something that a lot of people can identify with, which is people have a vision of something they're going to do or achieve, and they think it's going to go a certain way, and then they pursue that goal. They get it, and it is not at all what they thought, and they didn't understand all the consequences that would come with that. And so I think that is, even though you're telling a story in a world that's very different from what we live in, you're telling a relatable story. So my hat's off to you on that. That's great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, really, the point of storytelling, like our creative director, Sylvia, talks about, is like, the point of storytelling is one thing. Like, if you distill it to just one thing, it's catharsis, right? Because storytelling is part of art with a capital A, not just drawing, but like art with it. And the point of art is for emotional change within the audience, right? Mm-hmm. And it could be like, you know, if horror, it could be feeling elevated, it could be hopefulness, it could be it could be lust.
Yeah.
You know, with erotica.
Yeah.
It could be a lot of different things, right? And so I think for us, it's just like, if the story isn't developing that catharsis for the reader, it probably didn't do a good job. And so that's what we're trying to do. Even if it's a different world, you know, alien in a lot of different ways, it's like the point is the catharsis. And so that's always our North Star, if you will.
That's great. You know, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about just kind of the creative process and the medium. You could have obviously, with this world, kind of done a traditional novel, but you decided to go with graphic novella. What led to that decision? You know, how did you arrive at this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah. So that's very interesting, because initially I wanted to do these as a novel, because that's what I need. Like, in terms of the media that I consume, it's just like, aside from like streaming or whatever, it's really novels, right? Because, you know, to do streaming, you need to have a lot of money, a lot of capital, studio. I'm like, okay, that's not on the cards for me. So I'll write a novel. But for me, just like, you know, I try to not be too self-indulgent. Like, I have a very high opinion of myself, Uncle Nene, right? It's like undiagnosed narcissism. But when, you know, but still, I just like,
you wait a minute. Suffer from high self-esteem.
Exactly. And so, I said, look, before I get too far in the story development of this, let me talk to some people who might be in the target market. And it's like, hey, do you guys read books?
Right. So, like, good question.
talking to your younger people, right? You know, people who are like in college and maybe finishing up high school. It's like, what books do you read? And I'm like, books. It's like, we don't really read, but I'm like, oh no. And so for me, it's just like, it's very easy to be like a snob. Like, oh, they don't read prose. These peasants. But it's like, well, I mean, to be honest, a lot of prose these days isn't really targeted towards men. I mean, my genre is fantasy, right? And sure, it's a subgenre, dark fantasy, grimdark, whatever you want to call it. But my genre is fantasy, and if you were to look at like the biggest fantasy titles, like what's at the top of the bestsellers list, what are public, like legacy publishers really pushing? It's something called romanticy, which is romance and fantasy, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just like, let's be honest, that's a genre or a subgenre that mostly targets ladies, right? I mean, not to say that guys can't enjoy the occasional romanticy, but it's really mostly for the ladies. And so I'm like, yeah, I mean, so much legacy media out there is just not discounting the male experience. And even worse, saying that a lot of masculine attributes are toxic, inherently toxic. And so it's that kind of ideological attitude gets reflected in the media.
Does your graphic novel, does it kind of portray healthy masculinity?
It portrays both. Because I feel like, you know, it's just being like, I don't like Mary Sues. I don't like them when they're women or when they're men. And by the way, Mary Sues is this idea of in fiction where it's like you have a protagonist and they're a character that can do no wrong. They have no flaws. They're just think of how Disney did the Captain Marvel movie.
Right.
Which is like where she didn't really have any internal flaws. It was everyone else who sucked, but she was cool.
And
her only flaw was that she just needed to realize how incredible she really was, Uncle.
Right. That's yes.
And so it's like, okay,
your
well,
jam. That is not your jam.
That is not our jam. So for us, it's like, no, I mean, we need to, you know, we're exploring, if we want to explore healthy masculinity, we have to explore unhealthy masculinity, because no one comes out of their moms just being like, yes, I'm a completely mature man.
Yes. Right.
You know,
right.
Like, yeah. There's growth, right?
You have to go through some type of challenge or suffering before you're going to grow. You don't grow just because, well, I know I'm good, but I'm just going to be better. That's not how people go through life. We stumble, we trip, we fall, and then we're like, oh, I need to be a little more mature. I need to. So that's great.
And you know, I'm obviously saying, like, at the start of the series, some of our protagonists, some of the people who form the Brotherhood of the Wolf, they could easily be villains in other people's stories.
Right. Well, I talked about this the other day with another guest. We were talking about Game of Thrones, and we were actually talking about A Clockwork Orange as well.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how you can take a immoral person, unethical person, and make that character have some redeeming qualities. And later you find the audience cheering for that very same character that earlier was a menace. A villain, but then you realize that they have some redeeming qualities, they have some integrity, there is a code that they live by. So I think it's great that you're working in that world and in your stories.
Yeah, let me actually give you a little bit of a storytelling tip. If you want to
create,
like, how do you ensure that your audience likes your characters, even if your characters are anti-heroes or they're kind of naughty and bad in certain ways? Just follow this rule. Make sure that your protagonist does good things to good people and bad things to bad people. As long as you follow that rule, that's it. So your protagonist could be like Dexter style serial killer.
Right.
But one of the things that's compelling about why do we still root for Dexter? It's because he's a serial killer himself, but his serial killing is focused on other criminals, other serial killers.
Yes.
And for good people, he does good to them. So that's the thing. But if you break that rule in any way, like going either way, if your character does bad things to good people or is good to bad people, then people would be like, okay, I'm not really liking this protagonist.
That's interesting. So that's kind of like the rule of thumb. That's a great rule. Yeah.
Yeah. Regarding
the graphic novel. Yeah.
Regarding the characters, it's like exploring the idea of masculinity. You know, like we have four core characters who make up the Brotherhood of the Wolf. Koja, his thing is like, you know, dealing with the rage of what happened to him and the revenge, etc. And how do you navigate that? How do you be a truly good warrior while always having vengeance on your mind? We have Jem, who wants to love status, loves leadership, but you know, I think the best leaders don't understand the quality of service and the point of leadership is to serve. And so, like, that's the struggle he's going with. Haider deals with addictions, right? And so, he's also a doctor, so how does he navigate all that?
Oh.
And Munir is an alchemist, and he's just like a smart-ass know-it-all. And so it's just like, well, what's the point of knowledge, and what's beneficial knowledge versus not beneficial knowledge. And so these are the things that I think a lot of times men overall kind of struggle with. Depending on what kind of man you are and how you lean towards, one of these struggles might resonate with you more than the others. But that's the thing. It's just like, they start off having to mature because the only way that they mature is through trauma, which is why they have to fight these horrific monsters. But to your question is like, yeah. So since people in the target market aren't really reading prose, it would be very arrogant of me to be like, well, I'm just going to write it anyway and tough. Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay, well, let me see if I can make it in a visual medium that's not movies. Visual medium that we can do really well in. And it's like, okay, let's do it in graphic novel format, because I've always been a fan of manga, particularly, Japanese comics, essentially. And so it's just like, well, let's do that. And so we're doing it in a very like European style, bande dessinée style. If you know that genre of art, you'll notice like very detail oriented, very cinematic.
Okay.
And so it's not superhero-esque or manga-esque. It's really bande dessinée, which is.
Is it like Dark Souls? Is it similar to that, or are you familiar with
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you know what? It's the aesthetic vibe of Brotherhood of the Wolf. People have described it as Dark Souls, but I've heard more than one audience member say, "Oh, this reminds me a lot of Darkest Dungeon." If you know those video games,
okay.
And so it's like, yeah, it's got that Darkest Dungeon vibe, but with more realistic artistry.
That's great. That's so great. Yeah. What was it like collaborating with your illustrator, Professor Aurelio Mazzara? Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
I'm curious what that was like. What was that experience like? It's interesting from what I've read.
Yeah. Professor Aurelio is like, and the reason I call him professor is he's literally a comic book professor at the Scuola di Fumetto in Sicily, in Palermo, Sicily, one of the top comic book schools in Europe. And so, So it's just like, this isn't a fly-by-night thing. We really want to, this is a professional, high-quality, premium experience. And so we want to, to quote Pokemon, we want to be the very best. And so... my kids and my wife hate it when I sing, so they're not here right now, so I'm indulging. But working with him has been a blast. It's just a matter of like ensuring that what we write is very clear, and so that he can take it. And one of the things about working with Aurelio that I have not expected is like, yeah, he can draw all the cool stuff, the spectacle, the character designs that he does are great. But one of the things I did not count on, which is a really nice bonus, is the character acting. So like just the expressions the characters make, even in a very subtle way, I'm like, whoa, that is really cool. So it's just like, because it's not like, yeah, we wrote like, this is what happens, here's the dialogue. Sometimes we talk about expressions, but he takes it another level. So it's like, he's essentially the actor, but he's acting through the characters that he's drawing. And that was a nice bonus of working with him that we didn't expect, that people will catch on to it if they when they read, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I grew up reading comic books, graphic novels, and so it's something that brings back those familiar feelings. And so it's great that you're giving that kind of attention to it, because it does deserve it. I have, some questions about just kind of the fantasy genre in general. I think I'd love to get your perspective on, your take. What's your take on, and this is more TV and movies, so not books. What's your take on the current state of fantasy on screen? Anything jump out at you that like this was done really well or this was done really poorly?
Listen, we talked about the Song of Ice and Fire. And so just for folks who don't know, Song of Ice and Fire is the series that George R. R. Martin made. And the TV show based off of that was called Game of Thrones, which is the name of the first novel of the Song of Ice and Fire series. So just in case anybody's confused. And so I think the Game of Thrones TV show really brought fantasy back on the map, because before then we had the Lord of the Rings movies, which were great. And then people tried to do a whole copycat thing where I think they tried to, Chronicles of Narnia movies were pretty decent, I feel.
Yeah.
And then somebody tried to, I think, do something similar with His Dark Materials, the Philip Pullman stuff. That I don't think that really landed. Okay. So then after that, like explosion in the mid-aughts, things kind of just died out until Game of Thrones came along, and like people were like, whoa, because it was like fantasy, but it was very gritty fantasy. And so yeah. there would be like real politic. There would be like, you know, heroes who, you know, protagonists who were like, who had serious flaws and were not always good people. You had antagonists who were bad, but also you could understand them. Like, you could feel like these are like really three-dimensional people. Not to mention there was also more gratuitous violence. There was like sex. I feel like one of the things about the Game of Thrones series, actually, it probably ushered in the era of softcore pornography on mainstream television, unfortunately, right? Because it's one thing if you read that stuff on the page, but it's another thing if you like yes. in your face yeah. On HBO. And so I think Game of Thrones really brought back attention towards the fantasy genre that to a greater audience. But I think the final season kind of left a bad taste in people's mouths. Yeah.
I wasn't crazy about the finale, but yeah.
No. And then I think, you know, people, I think, still saw that there's any, because like, you know, in terms of like the literary world, fantasy is doing great. Right. Even if you look across the sea and look at manga, there's so much fantasy there as well. But when people try to do like, okay, let's see if we can replicate the magic of Game of Thrones, Amazon Prime try to do the thing with Lord of the Rings. And again, back to the Mary Sue problem.
Yeah.
A little bit. And so just like not respecting the source material in the way that, because here's the thing, whenever you want to adapt a series for a wider audience, you can make changes and the core audience will forgive you. But if you're making deep changes to the world, to the theme, you know, changes that aren't making anything better, but are kind of mutilating the property, the core fan base isn't going to be happy. And if the core fan base isn't happy, it's unlikely that your project is going to be successful. And yeah, I think that's the situation going on with Amazon's Lord of the Rings. And so, yeah, as far as the current state in fantasy in terms of movies and TVs, I think it's kind of slowed down a little bit again. Yeah,
one of the things that was great about Game of Thrones is the first season didn't have a lot of magic or otherworldliness. It was more just a gritty medieval political saga, drama. And then there was this kind of rumor of this magic. And then you would see a few things here and there, but it kind of ramped up as it went along. And I think what it forces you to do from a writing perspective is make sure your character development is on point and you get the people invested in the characters before you bring out the shiny object to sweeten the visuals.
Yeah,
So I respect that a lot. And to your point about the, you know, serving the core audience, I'm an easy audience to, you know, please. If you give me, you know, Rings of Power, I enjoyed it. I watched it. I like it. But if you give me Acolyte on Star Wars and on Disney, Acolyte totally flips the whole premise of the Star Wars universe, which is the Star Wars universe is Jedis are good, Sith is bad. It's pretty simple. And yeah. and then Acolyte comes along and it's well, maybe the Jedi aren't so good. And it was ridiculous. So for the core Star Wars fans, it's felt like a complete abandonment of the whole thing. That's very true in fantasy, sci-fi, any of those worlds.
1,000,000,000%. And, you know, here's the thing, like, it's like, and that show, what happened with Acolyte is, I did a video on it.
Oh, really?
And I think the title was something along the lines of like lesbian space witches. It's just like so funny. But like put the culture war and stuff aside and just looking at the story.
Take that aside, leave it the rest. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of when George Lucas he created this world, right? The idea of the Force wasn't so much this Manichaean light side of the Force good, dark side of the Force bad. It's just like the idea was, I think a lot of it was taken from Taoism. I'm not an expert in Taoism, but you might know more actually, so feel free to jump in, but if I'm misrepresenting anything, but essentially this idea of like the Force is the Force, right? And so when they talk about the dark side of the Force, it's about the aspect of the person who tries to control things.
Yes.
Whereas the nature of the Force is you just go with it, right? You don't try to control it. You just try to be at peace with it. Whereas the dark side of the Force is like, no, you're using your animalistic ego to control it for your own ends.
Right.
And so the whole, so I think, say what you want about the prequel trilogy. Yeah. You know, I think it did a decent job of like conveying that.
I went back and watched those, and it was like with a new set of eyes, and I have an appreciation for the prequel trilogy, because for one thing, he was, I say this, the lightsaber fights were way better. And then the other thing was the use of the Force was consistent. There was a consistent rules for how the Force can be used. Yeah. And I agree completely. It's interesting that, you know, whether it's fantasy or sci-fi, if you have respect for the source material, you will be rewarded. There will be a payoff there, because when you abandon the source material and, you know, totally reject it or betray it, it doesn't seem to work out in the long run.
No, it doesn't. And that, I think that's the thing with the Acolyte series is like, you know, because they didn't really understand or respect the source material, they're like, well, wouldn't it be cool if we flipped it? And it's like, okay, but you don't understand. So you're saying that the Darksiders are kind of the good guys. It means it's a celebration of ego and wanting to control things. Is that the theme that you want to explore with the audience, right?
Right.
And because even like talking about like the Jedi, like, okay, the prequel trilogy did already kind of explore how the Jedi were kind of ossified already, which made it easy for the Sith to kind of take them down to begin with, right? Like, Palpatine was able to like one shot like three Jedi in 3 seconds. I mean, it's already, that information is already conveyed to you.
Yep.
Visually, without having to be like, well, what if we made the bad guys the good guys? It's like, just stop, you know? And I think that's one of the things. If you want to adapt a work, you have to understand it, right? It's just like, you have to respect your audience, and you can't respect your audience if you're not respecting the core material that your audience is paying you money to adapt. It just doesn't make any sense. And one of the problems is that people are like, instead of taking that feedback and be like, you know what, we screwed up, we'll do better next time. It's be like, well, oh, those guys are toxic. They're just everyone's toxic. All these fans are all toxic. No, you're not doing your job. You're not professional.
Here's always been my thing is like, listen, you're Disney. You have more money than God. If you want to do something different than Star Wars universe, then do something different. Invent a new universe, right? Yeah. Don't adapt someone else's IP and then twist it, you know, just come up with something new. And there are creative people doing new stuff in sci-fi and fantasy all the time. So it is possible. You can be successful. I think it's just really lazy to take someone else's IP and then destroy it. So,
incredible. Yeah,
we agree on that. Before we wrap up, I thought there was something interesting I read here. I know that you mentioned you like Dune, you like Game of Thrones. And one of the things that I thought was interesting, you know, despite their different settings, they all ask the question, what will those in power do and whom will they sacrifice to stay on top? The Machiavellian quote, those with power will do anything to keep it. Those with no power will do anything to get it. Power is always explored. Sacrifice is explored. What do you have? Did you have anything in mind when you went to write this about power, about sacrifice? Was there something you were trying to say?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. Like there is a figure in history. His name is Ibn Khaldun, and he was from Islamic Spain. So many, many centuries ago. And you know, historians kind of credit him as being the father of modern sociology. And essentially, it was his work, his book, The Muqaddimah, that, do you know that meme that has, it's kind of a funny meme. It's like, strong men create good times create weak men create bad times. And then that circle over and over again.
Oh, right.
That,
right.
Okay. That
yeah.
meme.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. That meme is essentially a distillation of Ibn Khaldun's thesis in Al-Muqaddimah.
Interesting. A cycle.
That cycle, yeah. And so this idea that, And those are the ideas that Dune explores, by the way, if you notice, right? So it's just like, how are the Harkonnens defeated? How is the Imperium defeated? They're defeated because these like poor, hardy desert people beat them because they're more acclimated to a harder life than the Harkonnens or the Sardaukar are.
And how did they get that harder life? Because that was created by the rule of those, you know, it's like they create the hard conditions that then lead to their own demise.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's one of the compelling things about Dune. It's just like that cycle where it's like, it's less even about the story. Like, yes, there's Paul Atreides and his story arc, which is, you know, a very good one, but also just like exploring that cycle that Ibn Khaldun talked about all those centuries ago. And, you know, it's still even now, I mean, not to get too political, because I don't want to put your channel in trouble, but even now, if you look at what's going on in like Gaza, it's just like the same thing, like billion dollar military versus guys with flip-flops. It's just so funny. So it's just like, not to make like light of it, but like, it's just like that concept is like, is constant. Right. And so I think, I love exploring that. It's just like, okay, well, again, Brotherhood of the Wolf, a big part of that is an exploration of masculinity. Right. And so if you, men and women aren't the same. If you take a woman and you put her through super traumatic experiences, like violent experiences, like, yeah, a lot of times they'll be able to get out of that and go on with their life. But I think most of them will be broken in some way. I mean, men and women are different. Some people might disagree with me on that, but it's just like, it's super trauma. And I think that's why historically people have been very keen on protecting women from this sorts of thing, because they know it's very harmful. Whereas for men, it's different. Like, men actually need to go through an element of trauma and hardship in order to like be more useful, in order to grow. Whereas women, I think childbirth is hard enough, right? And so it's just like they have that. What do they call it? That thing where it's like you become an adult. Initiation ceremony. Okay. Like you notice, like for men in different cultures, there's like different types of initiation ceremonies. Like different tribes, they have different, like, oh, you need to go walk through this, like have all these ants come and just walk all over you and or other stuff. Whereas like there isn't really initiation ceremonies for women, because it's just like, well, it's just, you just live, right? And you give birth, and that's going to be hard. And, you know, you don't need an initiation ceremony, but men do. And so this idea of like, well, okay, how do you develop a good man? Like, yeah, there's the trauma, but then there's also needs to be virtue, right? Because if you come out of hardship being a psychopath, you're not, that's a problem. And by the way, that's, we have a character in the Brotherhood of the Wolf, Vlad the Third, who is known by something, a different name, Dracula. And he's in this setting, and he'll be kind of like an object member of the Brotherhood of the Wolf as a boy. And so the stuff that Oja and these other guys experience, he's experiencing along with them, but he takes a different set of lessons than they might. And so like Dune, I think the sociology was really nice. Game of Thrones, yeah, about power and justice. I think that's very important as well. But also, again, the whole idea of like hardship, like Daenerys, is, you know, and Jon Snow and Tyrion. I think of the three point of view characters, they're like go through some of the most difficult trials and tribulations. And so it's no surprise that they're considered the main characters of the overall ensemble cast, because like Daenerys starts off like broke and having to live among like horse people. So yeah, there's that idea, just like, yeah, hardship, you know, it makes it can make or break you, and so it's just like you need it in order to grow, but you need virtue as your kind of North Star so that you don't become a monster yourself. So those are the things I like to explore.
I think that's great. I think, you know, one of the things that you touched on that is absolutely true, that Game of Thrones creates this universe that everything is so hard and so brutal that you either become a monster yourself or you become a little brutal yourself in order to survive. There's some compromise. Very few characters make it through with their integrity intact. It's fascinating. That's why I think the world building part is so critical to the character development. You have to, they feed off of each other. And I think that's done great in Dune and Game of Thrones as well. One of the things I wanted to ask you, and then we'll wrap it up here, is, you know, religion and influence on belief is kind of explored in those materials. And, you know, the belief is power. If you get people to invest in something that is not tangible, then that is very powerful. And so do you explore that at all in Brotherhood of the Wolf? Because it was definitely kind of explored in Dune and Game of Thrones. So I'm curious if that's in your works as well.
Yeah. Yes, I do. And, you know, and I think one of the, I talked about some of the problems I wanted to solve in creating Brotherhood of the Wolf. And I talked about like the problems in the fantasy genre in general. Also, specifically, there are hardly any stories that kind of explore traditional Islamic principles. Generally, Hollywood's been satisfied in having like, doesn't really talk about Islam at all as a philosophy, as a theology, as a way of looking at the world. And when it shows Muslims as people, it's either as oil sheikhs, like bombers or belly dancers. And so those are, then that's so, fair. So it's just, yeah. So for me, it's just like, okay, let's do something where we're exploring like Islamic themes under the surface, but they're themes that anybody can like, they're uniquely Islamic, but they're still themes that people can resonate with, even if they're not necessarily Muslims themselves. So, for example, the lesser evil, we talked about the two of the lesser evils. Well, the concept of like choosing the two of the lesser evils, that's a concept in Islamic legal theory. And that legal theory comes from a verse in the Quran, which talks about like, fear God all you can. And then all, the idea is like, you know, fear God all you can, like try to avoid doing bad as much as you can. even if your circle of influence is limited. And, you know, there's this idea of a saying from the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who he said, like, you know, summarizing it is like, you know, the best thing if you see an evil is to change it with your hand. Mm-hmm. And if you can't change it with your hand, the second best thing is to change it with your tongue, i.e. with your speech. And okay. if you can't do that, then the best thing is to hate it in your heart, but know that that's the least of faith. That's like, that's the
right. That's the bare minimum.
That's the bare minimum. And so it's like, okay, so there's this idea of like choosing the lesser of two evils. And so with the lesser evil, the chapter zero, it's like, we explore that. But here's the thing, Uncle Nene, not a single Muslim character shows up in the lesser evil. Not a single one. Not a single one. And that's kind of deliberate, right? Because it's like, we're exploring the theme, but we don't necessarily need Muslims in it, right? And so, yeah. But then obviously like,
so there's a kind of subtext in your work there where you're exploring the themes that you're familiar with. And I think that that's great. I think when you can do that, I think that's phenomenal. You can tell that in George Lucas writings and what he was going through when he wrote Star Wars. You know, yeah. Darth Vader was based on his father. He hated his father. He had a challenge. And, you know, as the three movies go on, so does it parallel what happens with every father-son relationship, right? They hate their dad, and then their dad becomes the hero again at the end as they get older and mature. And so there's all of those kinds of things that influence that. So I think that's fascinating. You've taken your kind of Muslim understanding there and inserted the subtext in there. Yeah. I think that's great.
Yeah, and here's the thing. The important thing about theme is not allegory. Right. And a lot of times I think people these days be like, OK, well, we're going to make a story and the villain is going to essentially be Vladimir Putin. It's just like, okay. Right. Yeah. It's just like that's because, you know, allegory, it's like if you're basing it off of specific people or events, you know, they can come and go. You know, people are like, for example, George Lucas, he said about Palpatine, he's like, well, you know, I always thought of Palpatine as Richard Nixon, because George Lucas was not a fan of Richard Nixon. And he was the president at that time when the original Star Wars trilogy came out.
Yes.
I was like, okay, fine. But really, Palpatine, there's nothing about Palpatine that screams 1970s politics, American politics at you, right? So it's just like, because Palpatine is representing a certain theme. Yeah. And it's, sure, you could read Richard Nixon into it, but you don't have to. Whereas like another, you know, a less professional storyteller would be like, no, there's no other. It's obvious that this person this character is a specific person. And that's not very professional, because at a certain point, that person's not going to matter anymore, that politician that you dislike. And so then if your story's based off of that, how timeless is it really? So I think that the idea of theme is important, because theme is essentially a moral argument. Like I mentioned the whole thing about the lesser evil, choosing between the lesser evils, and that whole Islamic thing of like you change it with your hand if you can't. Yeah. I mean, that's a moral argument, and people can disagree with that. And so the nice thing about the theme is that you can have a story where you have characters who are arguing for it and other characters who are arguing against it. And then it becomes a push and pull tension type thing of like, okay, is the thesis of this argument, where is it going to go? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's,
I think what you touched on is great. I think that the lesser of two evils is a great idea to explore. It's a great thing to explore. I think of any time you can kind of present those choices where neither option is good. And what does the person do? What do they prioritize? I think that helps you invest in the characters. I think that helps you care more about it, because in real life, this happens, right? We live life and we're presented with choices that are not great. Either choice is a bad choice. It's not neither one. I'm going to suffer either way, right? So what do I do, right? What do I prioritize? And so I think that that's great. Thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I took up a lot of your time here, but it's been great. It's been a great conversation. Is there anything you'd like to tell the folks at home before we leave? There's something you'd like them to check out?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'd invite everybody who's interested in some of the things. Like, listen, if you like what I have to say, go to my website, Tales of Khair, TalesofKhair.com. Hopefully Uncle Nene might put them in the show notes. But TalesofKhair.com. And if you go there and you sign up to my free non-spammy email list, you'll get a free trailer. So what Uncle Nene showed here was a teaser. The actual trailer that I have, if you sign up to the email list, would be literally like 100% bigger. It's literally twice as much content. So you get everything. You get a lot more stuff. And for those of you who don't like what I have to say, you should still sign up just so that you could hate watch
absolutely.
And enjoy, because the hate watch, listen, hate watching is one of those aspects of life that is one of life's true delights. And I give you a lot of opportunities for hate watching. So for either camp, there's something there for you.
Yes. You mentioned you have kids. My daughters are grown up and moved out now, but, when my family, we would have bad movie night. I highly recommend you do that. We would pick a really awful movie and then we would watch it together and make fun of it the whole time. Very fun. Yeah. I encourage you to do that as well.
Exactly. Uncle Nana knows what's up.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for being on the show, Wes. For those at home, make sure you subscribe to this channel, Uncle Nana's Nerdcast. It's been a great show and we will see you next time.
See ya.